want to thank our sponsor, Aviate Watches, who are releasing their Dambuster Chadwick Mega Quartz timepiece, which pays tribute to Roy Chadwick, the visionary aircraft designer for the Avro Company, whose crucial contributions played a pivotal role in the success of the Dambuster raid during World War II. The watch has amazing detail, with one of my favourite parts being the 617 Dambuster logo as a counterbalance on the second sand. They come in three stunning colours, which you can find via avi-8.com or head to the description below for more details and links. Thank you and enjoy.
So, like, where Typhoon is now with the RAF and other European nations, is this where you expected it should be, or do you think it should have come sooner?
Everybody wants it sooner.
Yeah.
Everybody wants it sooner. But what a lot of people don't realise is just how comprehensive the testing has to be to make sure things are safe, airworthy, reliable, approved. There's so many regulators in the chain. There's a huge amount of work. Yes, you could probably, in a crisis, in war, you could bolt another weapon on and go off and do it. And you get what are called emergency operational clearances. A lot of them happen in the Gulf War onto a tornado.
Yeah,
that looks about right. That will do. It's fine. But to get the proper safe for little Johnny, new test pilot, to fly so his mummy doesn't get upset when he crashes and the lawyers don't get involved, there's a lot of work to dot every I and cross every T.
Absolutely. I should have probably asked this earlier, but all the maintainers, engineers, were they all ex-military or did they come from a separate company?
I can't talk for the other nations, but at Wharton and BAE Systems, a lot of them were through and through company trained apprentices in there. And they're people who've spent their lifetime working on prototype aeroplanes. Mm. We had a number of Air Force guys in getting first insight into what the airplane was bringing with it, because you can't just say, right, we've finished testing, over to you.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get the book out and start from there was guys embedded in all areas, all the different systems and all the different jobs, so that when the Air Force started taking delivery, it had a core of people that kind of knew what they were doing.
Yeah. And would you, on a social side, would you all mix, and like when you were out mixing, was it all Typhoon chat, or could you switch off?
No, we did socialise a fair amount. A lot of, with the four nations, each nation would take its turn to host what was called the cockpit committee, or cockpit group meeting.
Nice.
And so we'd all trips off to Madrid, or to Munich, or to Turin, or to Blackpool. they were always 2 or 3 day meetings, so you'd have time to socialise and, it wasn't a case of trying to outdo each other's hospitality, but we look after the group. Pilots will be pilots, and they'll talk about their job.
Yeah, absolutely. For you guys at home, Craig messaged me yesterday. He mentioned a few incidents. I know there's a few there, so maybe can you go through a few of them, because they sound fascinating.
Can we change the word to events rather
events.
Than incidents?
Incidents, right.
Incidents makes it sound like it was an accident, an accident in brewing.
Right.
There's lots of memorable things that happened. Let's start with when we were testing DA2 to make sure that the carefree handling bit worked. We obviously had to go to the very edges of the envelope, and in doing so, just in case, we had a bolted onto the back end of the airplane. It was like a tripod with a parachute, and that was called the spin recovery system. If the airplane were to lose control, one of the actions was to hit the switch to pull the spin recovery chute. And we did this in the simulator time and again. We made all sorts of contingencies of what could go wrong, so that the test team on the ground, the pilot in the cockpit, and for these sorts of tests we also had another safety pilot alongside on the ground, we're all looking at the parameters. We knew what we were going to do if certain things were going to happen. But the spin chute was there as a backup in case it would. Never used in anger in Earthbrook, never even close to it. We had to test that it worked before, and we'd done that. And as we were approaching my first flight to explore the edges of the envelope in the thing as an Air Force pilot, we'd gone into the simulator, and one of the predictions was that the airplane could get into a really flat spin. a high rate of rotation, centrifugal forces, think Top Gun, Maverick, all the rest of it, it might make it difficult to reach the switches. So the spin recovery switch itself, had a, with a, not an up and down switch, but it had a cover guard over it. You didn't want to knock it in action. So we decided that part of our checks before going into the manoeuvre, we'd raise the cover guard so that it was one less thing to do if we needed it in a bad situation. Fine, did it in the same, lots of time. Off we went to flight, climbing up through about 30,000 feet and right, go through the actions of what to do, do this, do that, raise the cover guard. Raise the cover guard, hit the switch. Boom, chute came out and disappeared off, going far too quickly. And there's a quiet voice on the ground saying, "What did you just do?" I go, oh. Because every cover guarded switch in every other airplane anybody's ever flown, you don't raise the cover guard and do nothing. You raise the cover guard to get to the switch.
Yeah, yeah.
So human error, human nature says, raise the cover guard, hit the switch. Which is exactly what I did. Chute pops out, drops off into the middle of the REC. Without the chute, there's no testing I can do at that point because we don't have the backup. So I've got 5 tons of fuel to use. Sorry, boys. Yeah, sheepish behavior. So that was embarrassing. So the words, "What did you just do?" echo with me.
It sticks in your mind.
Yeah, I go, oh, idiot. Other one, there's a picture out there of the a lovely picture of me pushing a TriStar along at sunset. The irony of that picture is I've just got 5 tons of fuel on board. There's the sun's going down in an airplane that at that time didn't have a clearance to fly in the dark.
Nice.
Right, so that was 5 minutes of full power to burn off the fuel to come back and land quickly. Displaying at Farnborough was awesome.
Yeah, what was that like? Tell me about that. And did you put your name in, or were they just like, "Craig, you go for it"?
There's really only one project, lead project pilot with each of the companies.
Okay, got you.
And at the time, the display was always done by a company test pilot, not a customer test pilot. So I joined the company by then, and Germany, the Berlin Air Show and the Farnborough Air Show, we kind of took it in turns to share the displays between my German counterpart and myself. Mm-hmm. And it came time, and I was there. It was my turn. Have a go. So there's a well-documented, well-regulated work-up sequence. You start mm-hmm. at the base height of 3,000 feet and work down in steps till you got down to 500 feet or 200 feet for manoeuvres. And then you've got to have your display authorised and approved.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And then you've got to go to Farnborough and they authorise it and display it before you do it in front of the public. You know, there's tragically lots of lessons learned from the past that are the reasons why these things are so well controlled. But, you know, sitting on the end of the runway at Farnborough, where as a kid from school watching Raymond Baxter talking about Harriers and ski jumps and all sorts of iconic things in history have happened at Farnborough. Here you are sat in the latest and greatest thing about to take off and display. Not without its incident on one occasion that we fly with smoke winders, the sidewinder bodies with diesel fuel and dye in there to make smoke trails in the sky. And it was fudged. I can't remember what you had to do, but we'd fudged one of the buttons on the stick that was the ignition for the smoke winders. But it was stupidly, it would light one, light the other, and then keep both going, so you had the 3 times to press the button. And it took a few seconds for it to start and stop. So at the end of the display, I was hit the button to make them all stop, but I'd started the sequence off again, so I was landed with one of these smoke winders still burning, and they need the air to go through to keep them cool.
Yeah.
Oh, what have you done? Again, what have you done now? Sorry.
We also displayed in Austria, is that right?
Well, I said that was one of the sad things. For some reason, the German test pilot wasn't able to do this display. It was a tiny little grass airfield stuck at the bottom of a valley. And they said, "Craig, can you come and do your Typhoon display there?" So I went across. And because of the location, I had to go and fly with the Austrian Air Force in one of their Saab 105 things, just to see, that it's like, ooh, this would be interesting, because there's steep-sided valleys, and it was big enough, but it's a subliminal thing. So we did that, and we can do this. But on the day in question, the bloody airplane wouldn't start. Yeah. We tried everything to make it start, restart. I never got to do that display, so that was a bit of a bummer. Being shot at is another that's pretty memorable.
Okay.
Start the briefing for it actually took place on April the 1st. So we go into the briefing room, and this is a set of testing we're going to do to test the missile approach warner. Missile approach warners, three little radars scattered around the aeroplane that do what they say in the tin. They'll warn you if a missile, a fast-moving projectile, is approaching. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've got to test this. So it's a bit terminal if you test it with real missiles. So how are we going to test this then? Oh, well, what we'll do is we'll put a Chieftain tank on the ground, and it'll point its barrel up, and you'll fly a parallel path, slightly displaced to one side, and at the appropriate time and space, the Chieftain will fire his gun, and the shell will go whistling past. No problem, job done. The system will detect or not detect it. The bit that worried me was the tank commander, not known for their intellect, tank commanders, said, before, you need to give us about 5 minutes warning before we're going to do the first one, because we want to warm up the barrel, because a cold gun barrel is less accurate than a warm gun barrel. Mm-hmm. I said, you can fire as many shells as you want, make sure that bugger's warm, because I don't want inaccurate shells whistling past. So we did that, and first trials we did were flying pointing the same way as the shell. So flew over the tank and then out in front of him, and he fired past. And he could feel the shock wave of the shell passing.
Whoa.
It was meant to be 100 meters off the wingtip. Still pretty close in my book.
Yeah.
And then later on, we did it on pointing towards him. So you could come out, it was all done off the Welsh coast in Aberporth. And you could see the tank on the ground, and you see the puff of smoke come up and go, course it's perfectly safe, and the system worked as advertised. I didn't know if it was working, so there was nothing in the cockpit to tell me it was working. It was all done in data recording back on the ground. But I've been shot at a lot.
That sounds great. Tell us about the visual inspection of DA4.
Oh, another embarrassing one. Minister for Defence Procurement, or somebody who was paying the bills, came for a flight in the two-seat DA4. Mm-hmm. And my colleague John Turner was the chief Typhoon pilot at the time, so he took him off. And it was very early days, and at that time, after the airplane had flown supersonically, it had to have a visual inspection done before putting the gear down and stuff. It just belt and braces, make sure nothing's happened. So I was assigned to do the visual inspection that, and flew underneath him. And if you ever look at the picture of the underside of a Typhoon at the nose undercarriage bay, you can see where the doors are, and there's a little D-shaped door thing, or D-shaped space at the back. Mm-hmm. It was a space. I thought, oh shit, it's fallen off. So I reported that the D door had fallen off, and then we very carefully didn't do any more flying after that. He just came back and landed. And then an hour or so later, one of the flight test guys came in with a picture. He said, Craig, is this the bit that you saw that was missing? Yeah, there isn't a bit there. It's a hole.
Oh, God.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, again. Sorry is a famous word.
Yeah, apparently so. This one interests me. Ouija board training.
Oh, Ouija board. The Ouija board goes back to the spin recovery system and preparing for carefree handling eventualities. There's... In the telemetry room we've talked about, you've got all these traces running, little heart monitor wires, when the airplane's doing things with its speed, its angle of attack, its angle of yaw, all the different parameters are there. And in order to train the team to react, the simplest way they came up with was create this Ouija board. It's a tall table. You need four people or five people around it, I think, and they all had little twiddly knobs that drove the pens on the traces.
Right.
So that they'd be their little hustle, right? It's going to do a practice manoeuvre, and they link to the simulator. and they said, we'll do a class three departure. And they all knew which way they had to, so that drove the traces that the safety pilot and the boffin were looking at. Mm. But they were all done manually. It was nothing clever software-wise. Right. They used that for the tornado, and they used it for typhoon, and I dare say they'll use something similar in the future. But getting it all coordinated so that you're in phase, so the traces look like, it was very clever.
Another point here, you text me, when is a clock not a clock?
When is a clock not a clock, yes. Job was to go and fly over Horse Guards Parade with DA2, Queen's birthday thing. There was a number of other airplanes, so it was you have to be there, time on target.
Yeah.
It was in the evening, about 7 o'clock. Time on target's one of the things, can't really screw this up because the Queen's there for a start. And you take off and walk and fly down to Colchester, and then you run in past the dome and all the rest of it. Everything's working to time. So I've got my watch on. I've got a lovely digital stopwatch in the aeroplane that's starting off. You know what time, so you know everything's got to be. I had two watches on, I think. So I know where all the times have to be where. And then halfway down to Colchester, I go, these don't tie up anymore. I don't know, some time has disappeared. I don't know what's going on. And it transpired that the aircraft stopwatch is wrong.
Right.
Was wrong. It was, again, early days, because it was based on the frequency of the avionics system. It wasn't counting exactly in seconds. It was counting in 50/60ths of a second. So over the 45 minutes, we end up with a few minutes adrift. So I revert to number one aircrew watch and got over the Queen on time.
Brilliant stuff. Is there one memory that really sticks out for you flying and testing the Typhoon? I mean, you mentioned a few there, but is there one that just never goes away?
I think it has to be the first flight. Mm. You know, in a single-seat airplane, in a foreign country, in an airplane that's got 14 hours on the clock, going, don't screw up. Yeah, that responsibility, that thrill, yeah.
Mm. And could you feel the takeoff difference? Yeah, like, let's say the lightning, would it, like, the burners kick in faster than the lightning, or was it similar? Or?
It was way, way faster. The reheat ignition in Typhoon, certainly that early standard of EJ-Gen was almost instant. Never seen anything like that before. With the F-15, for example, it's got five stages. You can feel each of the five stages.
Oh, can you really?
Yeah, slightly. But EJ-200s were instant, lots of power, lots of weight straight away.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of questions here from our patrons, if you're happy to answer them.
Sure.
Quick. So this is from Joe Kunzler. How do you think the Eurofighter performs against the F-16C, say, Block 40 or 50?
Extremely well. Remembering, of course, at the end of the day, it's the driver that's going to win or lose. You can give the driver the best tools in the world and he can still screw it up. Mm. So, single-engine F-16, thrust-to-weight ratios, if you start... Compare it pure mechanically in terms of thrust-to-weight ratio and lift-to-drag ratios and all the rest of it. Typhoon's demonstrably more capable in that regime. In terms of carrying number of weapons, more than that. In terms of what you're getting to see in the cockpit, data fusion, better radar, better sensors, everybody's going for the same aims.
Yeah.
It's how well you present them to the pilot at the end of the day that makes a difference. So, a very capable airplane. I know which one I'd rather have.
So this is from Golf 77. Which cockpit was the best that, like, you flew in? I'm guessing he means ergonomics.
The F-15 is a huge cockpit, lots of space to stretch out. Lightning, shoehorn yourself in there. Typhoon, nicely moderate, not too big, well laid out, and an exceptional amount of effort went into the design process to make sure that the cockpit was not an ergonomic slum. And that things were where they should be in the right sort of priorities, distinguishable, reachable, viewable, if that's a word. So, yeah, Typhoon, excellent.
This is from John. If you were in a drag race with an F-15 over 10 miles, who would win? depends on the altitude, I guess.
Depends, yeah. It depends on the altitude. Which F-15, C or an E or EX, which engines the F-15 got? It's got the 229s. I'm pretty sure Typhoon will win. I need to look at some of the data from more recent engine performances, but yeah, F-15's a big aeroplane. Square front,
yeah,
bit absolutely. Of drag.
And this is from Bill 50. If you could jump in the cockpit of any fighter you've flown for one last trip, which would you go for?
Lightning.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I was fortunate. I got to fly Lightnings after they'd left service. Mike Beachy Head in South Africa picked them up and was flying them. So I went and air tested that and then taught him to fly. Mm-hmm. Sent him solo, in fact. And it's quite strange coming back to the Lightning after flying all the different airplanes in testing. Mm-hmm. My fingers and my hands knew where to go without having to think about it.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, familiarity and the smell and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I think... if it were possible, but it's not at the moment, so it's not being good.
And this one's from Anonymous. Would you enjoy meeting up with your ex F-15 friends and talking about Typhoon?
I do.
Oh, you do?
I do. Yeah, variously. A lot of my F-15 friends are Americans. There's a couple of Brits, along with either who did exchange similar times, so we do talk about it. Fighter pilots will talk about their aeroplane. It's a chosen child, favourite child.
There must be a lot of banter as well. Back
there is. There's some people are better at banter than others. my Canadian friend Billy Flynn, if you're watching, he's pretty good at banter.
Like they're talking about the banter thing there. Does anyone get offended, or is it just indifferent to you? Like, there's no like, oh, how dare you?
Oh, you got to expect it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of my job was to go and talk at seminars and presentations and marketing bits and pieces, you know, selling the virtues of Typhoon and, you know, where possible, dissing the opposition. Marketing and what's out there in the press and what certain companies want to say about their airplanes.
Yeah.
Let's show you the real data. And there's lots of operational analysis tools out there that you can plug all your parameters into a simulator and repeat. Because if you put real pilots in there, they'll change, they'll do something different.
Yeah.
But if you want to actually quantitatively and academically study the difference between two, you've got to do thousands of runs to eliminate the randomness and see who wins and who loses. So data like that is endorsed by the government, so it's irrefutable that,
yeah. Yeah,
we put our model of Typhoon against your model of whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, data in is data in,
yeah.
Rubbish in, rubbish out,
yeah,
type of thing. But based on the best data available, this is the result you get. But it's still the pilot driving it at the end
absolutely
of the day. And
yeah,
if he messes up, yeah, you lose.
And did you enjoy the kind of, selling the aircraft and meeting the public, as it were? Maybe, did you meet the public, probably farmers?
Oh, yeah, lots of public, and that's always...
What was that like?
Well, it's what always struck me was how variable they could be. We had a cockpit simulator, big wraparound visual system, exactly like the airplane, flew really well. And you plonk people in there who know very little about flying, and you get the 12-year-old kid who could ace it, take off, land, and all the rest of it. And then you get the guy who's there with a stick, and the world's turning upside down, and he's got no concept of what's going. He's looking at something here,
yeah,
as he plows into the ground.
Yeah.
That bit always amused me. But 7 days at Farnborough talking non-stop through the same stuff. Yes, it's got 3D TVs, it can do this, that's the stick, that's the throttle. You go, oh.
And you must be media trained to go in front of the cameras. Or,
yeah. One of the best investments the company put in was how to do the media training bit, how to parry off the Paxman interview. Only on one or two occasions did I have any sort of challenging interviews that were trying to make a point. A lot of it was information gathering, they were on side. But one or two times, you know, they were saying, well, this is rubbish, it's a Cold War airplane, why does it cost this much? That sort of...
It's like almost clickbait at the time, like Eurofighter Typhoon test pilot says this, and you're like...
Well, that's a good one, that one. On after I'd flown DA7 for the first time. I gave a magazine interview to the MOD's in-house magazine.
Right.
So all the people who were involved in the program got the latest update where Craig flew this. And in that, I said, yeah, there's a few little handling problems, but they're all well known and the fixes are in the pipeline. And then one Sunday, I was at home and had the Sunday Telegraph opened up. And page 5 in there was, Eurofighter has handling problems, test pilot admits, exclamation mark. Squadron Leader Craig Penrice said, blah, blah, in the in-house magazine. And afterwards, it said what I said, you know, there's problems there. But the headline is, so Chief of Staff is on the phone to dear Craig at home on a Sunday saying, what on earth
What's
are
happening?
You doing? So, if you, well, this is what happened. But
yeah.
Press a life into themselves.
And one last question for me. Did you ever go to air shows, not even with Typhoon, but Lightning and do the static, and did you enjoy like interacting with the bubbly?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I
even the F-15, did you do that as?
Did I get to do it with F-15? No, I don't think I did with the F-15. Lightning, Hunter, Hawk, a lot with the Hawk.
That must have been fun.
It was good banter.
Yeah, I've heard that airshow hangar parties are really well.
Best party in the world was Riyadh, Fairford, when it was the 25th anniversary of the Red Arrows.
Right.
And everybody, blistering hot 4 days in, standing in there. Then on the Sunday night, they bust all 400 air crew down to South Cerny Airfield for a hangar party that was awesome.
Awesome stuff. So, one last question, sorry. How many hours did you get flying and testing Typhoon?
I think it's about just over 300.
Not bad.
Not very many. And as you're aware, my time came to a premature end. But I ticked all the boxes. I've done lots of things. So, yeah.
Sounds like that's a great time.
300 at that point in the programme is quite a big percentage of it. So, yeah, no, I was very lucky. Yeah.